In for this recording, your faces won't be shown.
And okay, so it's Tuesday, June 9th, which my wife just reminded me is my it's 2026, by the way, just for those in the future archived. It's my father-in-law's 97th birthday. He is still with us, not here, but anyway, on the planet, breathing. So good on him. And I was gonna say, there was something else I was gonna say, but you know how it is. Yeah, so I think we can start sitting. I was just gonna mention that I did record last week's class when Monica wasn't here. And today I'm going to try to catch up on the YouTube podcast recordings, which may or may not go well. One doesn't know. I will also mention, for those who might be in the Bay Area, that I will be at the Berkeley Buddhist Monastery tonight at 7:30. If you'd like to be with people's around people's other people's bodies, rather than just their, faces. So there's still time to book a flight. So if you want to come to the Bay from, like Colorado or somewhere like that, you could just hop on a plane. All right, so let's start with some sitting. Just settling into, a sitting posture, and having just taught for the weekend, one of the things I'm aware of is how tricky, how challenging it can be just to sit still. I think we often sort of have these ideas about what meditation is and how to do it. Maybe overcomplicate that. But if you just sit and try not to move, you'll find that that can actually be enough. Certainly enough to get you started and enough of a challenge. We could say that not moving the body is kind of the parallel to the not moving the mind. If you think it's difficult to keep the body still, you'll of course find that doing the same with the mind is even more challenging. But when the body is still, it sometimes can be easier to see the movements of mind, rein them in a bit, come back to the breath, come back to the body, to the stillness. And so as you settle in, just and bringing awareness to the sensations in the body, how you're holding the body, the posture, can notice areas of contact where you're touching your whatever you're sitting on. Maybe if your back is supported, feeling that. What sensations in the body are easy to feel right now? Maybe a little scan of the body to see what's standing out. And then, where are the areas of the body where there's very little sensation? Requires a little bit more subtlety of attention. And then beginning to focus on the breath. Feeling the touch of air at the nostrils or the movement of the belly. It's the life of the breath. Flow, the rhythm, touch, movement. And then noticing when the mind wanders from the breath. And initially, you can just come back to the breath when you notice. You notice thinking, when you notice that you've moved away from awareness of the sensations of breathing. Just come back, start again. Not thinking in terms of goals or doing it right, but just very patiently returning. And this is the first habit we want to learn in meditation, is to turn away from thought toward breath. It's the training to let go of thinking and to connect with this. This steady central element of life, the breath, something that's always there and can ground you into the present moment. And oftentimes, this is really the only strategy we need in meditation. Certainly, the 12-step language, more will be revealed if we simply do this. repeatedly. What is perhaps first revealed is the content of our thoughts. We start to notice persistent patterns. Coming to know our own mind. We don't need to dwell on these, certainly not make judgments, but just start to know. These are the habitual movements of mind. Moment by moment, letting go. And perhaps the next thing to be revealed is the causal relationship between what appears in the mind, what you see in your thinking, and your emotional life. And further, your lived life, your relationships. The way you function in the world, the way you behave. You see that thoughts are behind all of this. This makes us more acutely aware of the importance of seeing and letting go of thinking, particularly of unwholesome or unhelpful patterns of thought, self-judgment, judgment of others, fears, resentments. We see that these are not just random mental events, but that they are part of the pattern of our lives. It's not that we're going to meditate them away or achieve some perfect mental state, but that we can become less the victims, less the carried along by these habits of more agency in our thoughts, in our behaviors. In our emotional life. Okay. It's couple things on my mind. But I think I will start with something from Jack Kornfield that I may have probably referred to this last week as well. And I've been using his book, A Path with Heart, as well as the one that kind of follows that, the Wise Heart. Doesn't follow it, but it was many years later, but very similar book. There's this one phrase, one sentence that struck me many years ago when I first read it, and has had a huge influence on my practice and my teaching. And think the idea will be familiar to anybody who's been sitting with me for a while. So this is from page 105 in A Path with Heart. When any experience of body, heart, or mind keeps repeating in consciousness, it is a signal that this visitor is asking for a deeper and fuller attention. So it occurs to me that when we're meditating and there's something that keeps repeating, our tendency is not to give it more attention, but to try to get rid of it. And I think it's one of the sort of misunderstandings of meditation that we are trying to control our minds in some direct way. I'm gonna make it do this, and if this is happening, I'm just gonna get rid of that. I'm gonna go make it go over here. And it doesn't work like that, as anybody who's practiced to any degree knows. In fact, the mind really rebels when we try to treat it in this way as some kind of a spoiled child that we're gonna, give a time out or send to the room. So instead, as Jack says, we need to turn toward it. And this, as I talk about so much, is challenging on many levels. First of all, because we're talking about something that's unpleasant, in the generic language of the suttas, it's an unpleasant experience, an unpleasant Vedana. Something that's just going on and on in our mind. And so it is instinctual to not turn toward the unpleasant. And part of that instinct is, maybe I can say, manifests as fear, or maybe that's just what it is. Because, again, going to the sort of fundamentals of human survival instinct is that pain is an indication of danger in our DNA, in our evolution. And the purpose of pain is to warn us of danger and alert us that we need to take some action because the danger ultimately can lead to death. And this is just, I'm just talking really about the primal instincts. They're not things that we are thinking about when we have a pain in our knee, or we can't stop thinking about some problem in our lives. It's not that, my mind is spinning and I'm thinking, oh, I'm going to die. But that's how we're wired, to protect ourselves from death. And people talk about ego death, but I think here we don't even need to become that subtle or sophisticated. Just talk about physical death, and that if that pain, right, discomfort is an indicator that we're at risk, and that ultimately the ultimate risk is death. And so that kind of gives makes it pretty clear why we would want to avoid pain. Like, we need to, again, the instinct is, I need to get away from this pain or I might die. And when I think of that, I think about, I mean, it's not exactly a side point, but that, when I had the craving to drink and to use drugs, the only way I can characterize the feeling that need was that if I didn't respond to that craving, that I would die. And again, this was never conscious. And it, had it been, I would have known that that wasn't true. But the pain of that craving was unacceptable, and triggered that underlying sense of compulsion that I have to respond to this. And so when we hear this teaching, this, I'm going to read it again. When any experience of body, heart, or mind keeps repeating in consciousness, it is a signal that this visitor is asking for a deeper and fuller attention. It can sound like, okay, I'll just do that. But when we actually, undertake to follow this instruction, we run into the wall of resistance. So, yeah, I mean, this is tied directly to addiction, because our addiction was very much a wish to escape pain. And it's interesting, I realize that, Jack isn't saying in this that there's something that's repeating in consciousness that's painful. But I think we can infer that if something keeps going around in our mind, in our body, something keeps showing up, that there's some discomfort or some agitation in it. And so there's this problem of, how to turn toward. And this comes up from time to time when people are talking about physical pain in meditation. That certainly don't people don't ask, oh, how can I turn toward the pain I'm having? They ask, how can I deal with the pain I'm having? And the underlying question being, how can I get rid of it? But, I was taught very early on to turn toward the sensations. Now, I'm talking about sensations that were prompted by sitting still in a particular posture. I'm not talking about chronic pain or acute pain of some injury, although mindfulness applies there as well, but has to be handled in a more careful way. But as for what I would call meditative pain, the pain that arises physically through sitting still for extended periods of time, turning the attention toward it is a really powerful tool. And so, this is in some ways simpler than turning toward the persistent, and as Jack calls them, insistent visitors of the mind. But I think when we get a sort of understanding of that process, it can inform the more subtle process of working with the mental discomfort. So with physical discomfort, first thing we have to do is relax, actually, because physical discomfort tends to cause tension in the body. We clench in order to hold it off. And so as we relax and soften, we're allowing the sensation to be there and we're allowing ourselves to feel it. So that means that instead of trying to put our attention somewhere else, or just pay attention to the breath or get really concentrated, or that we are voluntarily saying, I will try to feel this. I'm willing to feel what this sensation feels like. So again, there's this kind of resistance and clenching, but if we carefully turn toward it, and in this process, we kind of almost have to continuously relax because there is this kind of, persistent signal that we have to resist, and we have to kind of keep meeting that. And so the breath is quite, clearly the partner in this process, breathing, relaxing, breathing, relaxing, turning toward, and then arriving at the sensation itself. And what's striking, I think, first of all, is that you don't find the center and you don't find a solid thing. What you've and this in some ways makes it harder because it's like you're not looking, like I'm looking at a stable screen in front of me, just a thing. I can just look at it. It doesn't move. And especially if you guys don't move. It's just there, right? But when you put your when you try to pay attention to a sensation in the body, what you find is that it's not, you can't find it. And it can be kind of frustrating and confusing because it's there. You're feeling it and it's unpleasant and you're still like, ugh, ugh, ugh. But you start to see, okay, this is what they mean by impermanence. Impermanence is not the all-encompassing word meaning of the word anicca, which is the Pali term. So in impermanence also means instability. So that's another actual translation of the term anicca, unstable. So that when you start to feel a sensation, and I'm thinking about the years that I spent just taking my attention into my left knee, which now has been replaced, so I don't have that sensation anymore. That when I would sit cross-legged, my left knee, well, whatever, my right knee, both knees at different times, anyway, would start to, burn after 20 minutes or so, half an hour, depends. And as I say, I would take the sensation there, and it was like this wiggling thing, this, and also a throbbing thing, because it pulses, right? And and sensations, and I don't really like to call it pain, but for the our purposes, I will. Pain moves with presumably the pulse of blood, and so it just kind of grows, shrinks. And you're trying to pay attention to it, but it's like, where is it? What is it? And what's and teachers would talk about, oh, try to find the center, try to find the perimeter, and again, you'd be like this, just moving. And so, and then there's this, again, this persistent resistance to it and having to let go, observe, let go, feel, be with, let go, breathe. So, first of all, we're getting this realization, another word for insight, that what I think of as a thing, as an object, is not. It's unstable. It doesn't have that kind of form. It's a flow of sensations that expands and contracts. And that, so that's, lesson number one. And that it becomes much more manageable and tolerable when I'm not resisting it, which again is going against my instinct, which says I have to get away from this. But when I can override that instinct and stop fighting with it, it goes from being, unmanageable to manageable, I could say. It goes from being pain to just unpleasant sensation. And then, what started to become apparent to me was that when I had my attention on the sensation and I was not resisting and it was just unpleasant, that was fine. But if my mind would wander, my body would immediately clench. So like if I'm not keeping persistent contact with the letting go, with the non-resistance, the instinct of the body just kicks in and the body tightens again. And then the pain flares. Well, that's, unpleasant, but also gives a motivation for being present with it. But further, what the result of that, and this is why, I recommend working with this. And I will say that in my book, my workbook, Buddhism, the 12 Steps workbook, I have a whole like long section called the Dharma, I think called the Dharma of Pain. Anyway, something like that. It's like step six. Anyway, what this is the kind of really interesting thing and the payoff, I will say, which is that because the pain became a quick signal that we can call a mindfulness bell that told me my mind had wandered. And so as soon as my mind wandered, I would know it and I would be able to like come right back and let go. Because when I'm paying attention, when I'm using my breath as a tool for concentration, if my mind wanders off my breath, there's no signal of that. I don't know it until I randomly wake up, as we do, and go, oh, wait, my mind's wandering, and I come back. But working with sensation in this way meant that my mind wandered less and less. And in fact, ultimately, that's how I developed the strongest concentration I've ever had. Now, this is not a very appealing invitation. How to develop concentration? Sit with pain. Very few people are going to, take on that challenge. Only those who are, devoted or fanatical. But it just was very striking to me that how this process played out. And nowadays, because I can't get into that posture, I don't sit with pain, and my concentration is not as strong. And that's probably also because I'm getting old. Concentration sort of rises and falls. Just really interesting. And this isn't to say that there aren't other ways of developing concentration. There certainly are, and probably more appealing methods than this. But it's something that, I feel, I guess a responsibility to talk about this, because is something people don't want to hear. I guess. I don't know if they don't want to hear it, but it's an unappealing teaching. And I think that there's a tendency as a meditation teacher to try to make everybody happy, tell them what they want to hear. And I think it's important to understand some of the, things that are not so easy to look at, to work with. So I didn't know that that was going to be where I wound up talking today, as I usually don't know when I start out. There's some other things. I was talking about, well, I don't know. I guess I will let people chime in at this point. I see that there is a virtual hand up from Sarah. So go ahead.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks so much. I love these talks. I'm so fascinated by this whole idea of the sacred pause in meditation. And so you're talking about pain today. And I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the perimeter of pain. I'm not sure I quite grasped what you were saying with that. And then also this time between the stimulus of the thought that you're having or the pain that you're having and your response to it.
So the perimeter of pain, you're talking about like the physical perimeter, is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I think you said something about how some other teacher was talking about when you're assessing the perimeter of pain and that you shouldn't think of it, that I wasn't quite sure I
Yeah,
ended
so
up.
what I'm talking about is like actually the physical, like where is the edge of it?
Yeah.
Because, right? Because it's not like, particularly like using the knee as an example, it's like there's a sensation around the knee, but it's and then it ends. It's like and the reason for this really is to see that there isn't an edge, that there isn't a center. Like look for it, but you won't find it, kind of, and that instead you will find this moving mass of sensation. I don't know if that answers the question.
I mean, this is one of those areas where words are kind of inadequate to describe what we're experiencing. And you're an advanced practitioner, and I'm sort of a newbie, but I'm grasping it sort of, as I practice.
I mean, we can do this with any sensation, like explore its qualities. It's just that with this type of sensation, this unpleasant or painful sensation, because it's very distinct, we can see it. Right now, your whole body, inside and out, is experiencing a bunch of sensations, but they're very subtle, right? And they're not calling for attention. So it's difficult to like bring mindfulness to your right thumb, for instance. I'm going to do that right now. Feel my right thumb. But you can do it. And so let's maybe do this together. I don't know. I just had my hand up in the air, so I thought of my thumb. So maybe anybody who's interested, try putting your attention just in your right thumb. And notice what you feel. And I don't mean, well, yeah, just notice what you feel. So, are you able to do that, Sarah? Can you describe what you experience?
Kind of a like a tingling, maybe warmth, something like that.
And can you locate with your mind like a center of that?
Not really.
Right. So it can you feel how it is something that is moving, unstable?
Yeah, it emanates and you just don't know where it ends, I
Yeah,
guess.
right. Yeah, so this is the nature of sensation. And so this might sound like some kind of esoteric teaching, but really what it's pointing to is insight into self. And what I mean by that, so another way to do it, another way to say this, when we say there's no self, we could also say there's no thing. So a thing in our minds is a solid object, a solid unchanging object. And we view the world as made up of solid unchanging objects. But as soon as we pay attention to any individual thing or feeling or thought, anything, we see that it's not solid and unchanging, but that it is in fact this really more of a process or an energy than it is a thing. Now, again, that could seem like, okay, so what? But what the where we take that then, where we take that insight into self or to thingness or no thingness, is that it changes our relationship to things. When we think of things as solid, we operate in a certain way. And this is particularly true of emotions and sensations, but also objects. And we relate to things and to people as these unchanging things. But when we think of them and when we realize and have this shift and understand that they are not unchanging things, they are dynamic processes, then we relate to them differently. You know, and particularly around emotions, which, you know, my favorite topic. You know, when you think of an emotion as a solid thing, it's like, I've got this problem that I'm walking around with. What am I going to do about it? But if I think, oh, this is an energetic phenomenon that's unstable, that's arising, changing, and that even how I what I think it is, in terms of naming it, like, is it sadness? Is it fear? Is it anger? That is just a creation of mind. And so now your whole relationship to the world changes. And that's what this practice is actually meant to lead us to this shift in, we could call it point of view, perspective, understanding, the way we understand reality, the way we understand ourselves, the way we understand the world. And it all starts, and this is the brilliance of the Buddha, it all starts with this simple examination of a momentary experience. You know, the breath, a sensation, an emotion, a thought, and just seeing it. And as we penetrate into it and look more and more closely and reflect more and more deeply on it, we have this breakthrough where we see, oh, it's not what I thought it was. Reality is not what I thought it was. And this is, you know, as I say that, what comes to mind is the psychedelic experience, which, you know, I speak against as a person in recovery. I don't recommend using psychedelics because I consider them very dangerous. However, you know, for those of us who have had those experiences, realize like that's very much the lesson. Though usually a lot of us didn't get it because we were just busy getting high. But if we were really paying attention to what the psychedelic experience reveals, it's that reality is not what we think it is. It's a construct. So, okay, just a little light ideas here. Nothing too deep. John M.
Hey Kevin, this is a great topic, and thanks for going through it. It reminded me, and again, I'm going to not quote you directly, but from the retreat I was at, because we know
Uh-oh.
how painful that can be.
I know. Well, I got in trouble because I remember saying I didn't say that, and you were like, "Yeah, well, you actually just did." And I was like, "What?"
So,
Yeah, so one of
what
my
you said
fond
at the
memories,
retreat,
John. Thanks for letting me remember.
I know, Kevin. It's great to bring it up every time.
Yeah.
So you said something that was very helpful at the retreat. You said, look, before, and sitting, I'm experiencing different kinds of pain and itches and so
Oh,
forth.
good.
You said, before you move to relieve it, do just what you've been describing this whole session. And I thought that's a great prelude to that process, which is, well, if I'm itching or scratching, the first impulse is to, like, reach up or reach around or do something. And I think that stopping before I want to try and avert, right? It's an aversion to the itching or the pain was a very help. And I still use it. I've changed my sitting so that I'm not, inducing pain in my knees and those things. But
Ah, too bad.
well, that was my other thing.
You're missing out.
Was thinking of religions where self-flagellation is a
Yeah.
huge part of the
Right.
process, and
Right.
it's exactly, I'm sure they go into a trance state that's,
Yep.
ecstatic for them. So,
Yep.
but
Exactly.
thank you very much for the reminder about the pain
Yeah,
process.
and thank you for that. That's a good offering, because if we approach it as like, I just have to tolerate this and deal with it without any end in our mind, then it's going to be much more difficult to manage. But if we think, oh, I can move, it's okay, but before I do, let me examine this. Let me take a moment. That's a really good like way to kind of balance the like, well, don't turn it into self-flagellation, but don't let me just immediately run from it. So let me just take, oh, wait, I really want to move. Oh, wait, what's this impulse to move? Why is that there? What's causing that? Let me feel that. Let me breathe with that. Let me allow it. Okay, and then now I need to move. And so, yeah, thank you for that reminder. Paolo.
Hey, I apologize for not being on screen. I'm sick as a dog, and I'm surrounded by construction. I'm sure you can hear. I'll keep it short. It's not a comment or question, Kevin. It's just I want to say thank you. This terrain that you map, this intersection of recovery and Dharma is invaluable. The way in which you do it is invaluable. The humility and the humor that you bring, I just love. You make these things that are at times so highfalutin, so down to earth. And you do it with this real humility and this real humor, Kevin. And it's not always punchline humor. It's just this kind of bubbling, like I'm willing to look at things from a very human point of view. And I don't know, you're making some things that maybe we haven't quite reached yet, and you're making them very tangible. I just want to say thank you. It's like every one of your talks, Kevin.
Thanks,
Thank you.
Paolo. Appreciate it. Yeah, I mean, I was talking this weekend up in Grass Valley at Mountain Stream Meditation Center about, the job of the meditation teacher is to, I view part of my role anyway, is to help people put together things that they already sort of almost know. And that, Joseph Goldstein's first book, as I love to point out, is entitled The Experience of Insight. And the point being that insight in Buddhism isn't an idea, it's an experience. But the way the experience becomes an insight is when it's the understood experience, right? And the job of the Dharma teacher is to help you to understand what you've already experienced. That's why I think what you're referring to of like, oh, making it down to earth, it's like, well, yeah, because if you've been sitting or living or being an addict, you've had all these experiences, but and that like when you just have to like have be shown how to fit them together to have insight. So thank you. I do, yes, I want to thank Monica as always for being so helpful in recording these, and as I said, I have to catch up with getting them online, and but I'll do that shortly. And she put in the links to both the books of Jack Kornfield's that I referred to, and then even a ref a definition of impermanence, cool. And then she's also put in information about how to offer me Dana, which is delightful. And then I want to just mention that this Friday is my Spirit Rock class at 6 p.m. And it's been much less attended, I will say, than this class, which is interesting, because one would think that people would hear about Spirit Rock. But anyway, 6 to 7:30, and I've been going through the Noble Eightfold Path, so it's a little bit more structured in terms of the teachings. And this I'm going to be talking about right intention this week, I believe, if you are interested. So hope that people can come to that. I see you've also put in the link to the Southern Dharma Retreat, which is my next really major teaching. I'm kind of taking a break other than this and my usual monthly things for the next couple months, which I kind of need right now. But I am going to be sitting starting next Tuesday. I'll be here, and then I'm going to go off and sit for a week. And at the end of that, the retreat's going to end on the following Tuesday. I built it around this class. It's sort of strange, but there you go. That's and so I'm going to have a week of sitting, which I haven't done for a while, just like on my own. And looking forward, hoping that that will help me to, figure it all out and come back with all the answers. Actually, I'm hoping maybe it'll give me some new ideas for maybe a new book, because I something help. Anyway, I'll be, as I said, I'll see you guys next Tuesday. And if you can make it on Friday, even just to make me feel like people love me. No, let me. That would be codependence. You don't have to do that. But if it'd be of benefit to you to come on Friday, please do. Otherwise, see you next Tuesday.
Thank you, Kevin.
Yeah, thanks, Deborah. Nice to see you.
Thank you, Kevin.
All right, folks. Yeah,
Thank you,
Charmaine,
Kevin.
thank
Thank
you.
you.
Take care, everybody.
Thanks, Kevin.
Bye.
Bye.
Much love.